It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and today we're all about mouth-watering, lip-smacking, rib-tickling barbecue.
Where's the guy that cooking his shoulders? Well, you're looking at her.
The meat that they're waiting for isn't from a pig, it's from poor old Andrew Jackson.
That was you on fire, pal.
Everyone likes barbecue. Supersized slabs of juicy ribs cooked over a wood fire until the meat slides right off the bone. Smoky pulled pork sandwiches with a side of homemade coleslaw. Food doesn't get much more American than barbecue. It's part of our roots, and it's also tangled up in our racial history. But today, barbecue is undergoing a renaissance. Young people are ditching careers on Wall Street to become pit masters. Barbecue fanatics will drive hundreds of miles just to eat smoked ribs off a paper plate in a shack by the side of the road. And if you're thinking, well, anyone can stick a chicken on a backyard grill, that's not barbecue.
Barbecue is a marriage of smoke and meat and time and expertise. It's that simple. I mean, it's the most elemental of American foods, and yet it's not a simple food. To cook great barbecue requires great knowledge, a long time in the pits, and a deep understanding of your clientele as well.
John T. Edge is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. And you notice the one thing he didn't mention? Barbecue sauce. So, okay, I'm a northerner, but when most people up here in the north think about barbecue, they think, yeah, sauce.
Well, bless their hearts.
Come on, really? Don't you have to have sauce? You go to stores, you see all those jars of, you know, so-and-so's famous sauce. Then there's the other more famous sauce.
Sure. And sauce is a great gilding of the barbecue lily. It's not the primary event. Sauce is a way to define barbecue geography, and it serves us in that way. But sauce is, you know, what you apply after you've done all this hard work. It's not the hard work.
What do you mean when you say sauce defines barbecue geography?
So you can map the South by way of sauce. A generation ago, a geographer from the University of South Carolina, a guy named Charles Kovacic, developed a barbecue sauce map of South Carolina. And he isolated county by county how sauces varied, from vinegar-based sauces on the eastern flank to mustard-based sauces in the center, and sweeter, kind of redder sauces, ketchup-based sauces as you move further west. And that was just South Carolina that he defined by way of geographical overlay of sauce. You could do that for the whole of the South, and South Carolina is kind of a microcosm of that.
Wow. It's like barbecue is an actual language.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a way for Southerners to communicate, most certainly. Barbecue is its own sort of language.
Is this why I've read that you've described barbecue as our national folk food?
I think it is. It is this kind of cultural product that we all recognize. Say the words barbecue, and people recognize the form. Their mouths begin to water. And they also begin talking about the differences. So the superstructure is barbecue is American. Beneath that, barbecue is Southern. Beneath that, barbecue is local. Each layer of that conversation is interesting, but those conversations all add up to this notion that barbecue is our great American folk food.
Hmm. Now, you've argued that we're entering a new golden age of barbecue, that there's, I don't know, a barbecue renaissance or something going on. What's happening?
There are two things happening. One, a new generation of Americans recognizes the value in kind of elemental American foods. Hamburgers, fried chicken, hot dogs, apple pie, barbecue. Whereas before they might have aspired to eating French food or Italian food or Japanese food more recently, now people aspire to American food, both as eaters and as cooks of that food. There's a new value ascribed to that food that wasn't the case before.
So are you saying that, like, in the culinary world, the world of, you know, James Beard Awards and expensive restaurants, in that world, barbecue is becoming more recognized or quote-unquote respectable?
Yeah, I think across the entire dining spectrum. I mean, if you take the James Beard Awards as an example, this year, for the first time, a barbecue pitmaster was nominated for Best Chef Southwest. And it was amazing that barbecue pitmaster, Aaron Franklin of Franklin's Barbecue in Austin, Texas, was nominated. Even more amazing, Aaron Franklin won that award, beating out a host of white tablecloth chefs. That says something about this American moment.
So who are some of the barbecue greats right now? I mean, who are the, I don't know, the Thomas Kellers or the Alice Waters of barbecue today?
One of the most respected is a gentleman named Rodney Scott. And Rodney is in Hemingway, South Carolina, in the PD region of that state. Rodney, when you talk to him about what he does, and Rodney cooked his first pig when he was 11 years old. Rodney grew up in a farming family, a family that had a country store out in the sticks just beyond the city of Hemingway. And when you talk to Rodney about what he does, he'll talk to you about going out in the woods to chop his own trees. The interesting thing about what Rodney says about cooking barbecue is that when he goes out and chops down his own trees to cook his barbecue, he compares it to a chef going out in the garden to pick his own tomato.
Farm to table. This is woods to table.
It is. It's completely.
That's great. So here's one guy who, from the sound of it, you know, grew up on this tradition. But there are others you've written about, like there's a guy named Tyson Ho who runs Arrogant Swine in Brooklyn, and from what I've read, he gave up a career in finance to become a pitmaster.
Yeah, I think Tyson Ho is really interesting. He's on the kind of industrial fringe of Brooklyn and gave up a career in finance. Tyson Ho said to me that he chose to cook barbecue because this is the oldest style of American cooking. He wanted to cook barbecue because that was his way of claiming his Americanness. Tyson Ho is a child of Asian immigrants. And in cooking barbecue, he was claiming his Americanness. Tyson Ho was saying to me that by way of cooking barbecue, he was claiming an American past that was just as much his as someone who came over on the Mayflower. And he said it with pride, not with indignation. He said it with pride. And he recognized that barbecue was that kind of pathway to American identity. And that was the one he chose, that he left behind finance and barbecue was his way. Plus, the barbecue's pretty darn good.
Does barbecue get racially complicated? Because I've seen old photos of, you know, big barbecue events, and you see a bunch of white guys who basically are supervising or pretending to supervise a bunch of African-American guys who are actually the ones doing the cooking.
Right. That's the kind of WPA-era photo you always see of an African-American man tending the pit while a white fellow in suspenders and a big Panama hat as he gazes upon the work of the African-American man. And that has typically been the way it's portrayed. The reality is something different. There's a real hinge in American history. You know, peg it at like the late 1920s, early 1930s, when if you look at the literature and the references to barbecue, you see in that moment that African-American men begin to be referred to as pitmasters.
And I suppose the second half of that word is interesting, pitmasters.
Yeah, it is. The notion that an African-American man who until the 1860s was considered a slave, and now that man is considered a master. He's the master of his job, of his domain, garners respect because of his work, and that man is now called a master is a heck of a pivot, you know, comparatively short amount of time.
So is barbecue widely regarded as an African-American tradition? Because I thought there are also places in the country where there's sort of some debate or conflict over whether barbecue is black or white.
I don't think barbecue is black. I don't think barbecue is white. I think barbecue is uniquely American. I think our culture is an amalgam of influences. I do think, though, that because of the peculiar racial history of this nation, we've long kind of failed to recognize the expertise of African-American pitmasters. What we're doing now is kind of paying down a debt of pleasure to the past and to those old guard pitmasters. That's where we stand now.
What do you mean, pay down a debt of pleasure?
Well, if you think about, I don't know, for me, I grew up a half mile from a barbecue joint. I knew the name of the owner, and I knew the name of the woman that stood behind the counter and chopped the meat. But I recognize, looking back, that I didn't know the name of all those men who worked those pits. And by way of making films about this with the Southern Foodways Alliance or writing, one of the things that I'm attempting to do with my work is pay down a debt of pleasure to say thank you. And one of the ways to say thank you is by way of offering earned recognition that has been long been defrayed.
So has barbecue played a role in the history of race in America or racial politics?
Yes. One of the signal battles of the civil rights movement was staged at a barbecue restaurant. Ollie's Barbecue in Birmingham, Alabama was one of the signal court cases wherein Ollie McClung and his family refused to integrate their restaurant. They would serve African Americans at the rear, and their employees were almost exclusively African American, and yet they chose not to serve African Americans in the dining room. That story is told numerous locales across the South, at Vandy's Barbecue in Statesboro, Georgia, at Ayers Log Cabin in rural North Carolina. These restaurants, these barbecue restaurants, were some of the last holdouts in integration in the American South. And for many of those white owners, they couched this in terms of property rights and said, this is my restaurant, and I treat my restaurant like my home, and I get to control who enters and who exits. Of course, that did not hold up after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, and restaurants were forced to integrate. But the argument that my restaurant is my home was the one they made, the one they stood behind, and the one that did not serve them well in the end. We think of barbecue and barbecue restaurants as this great democratic institution, small-d democratic institution, and we should. And yet, for the longest time, they failed to live up to their principles. And since the 1960s, that's been corrected. Now you see a kind of integrated South communing at the tables of barbecue restaurants, which is the way the food was conceived and executed and what was intended. And that's, to me, great progress and is another reason that barbecue serves us as this kind of folk food. It was a problematic food set back on the right path. And that's one of the reasons that kind of tension, the knowledge that comes with that kind of tension, the knowledge of barbecue's past, is one of the reasons that I enjoy communing there now, to think about a broken institution now righted and fixed, a broken institution now celebrated, a broken institution now rich and vibrant and progressive.
So does that make it complicated at all for you as a white guy going to and sitting down at a traditional barbecue joint?
To think about that past?
Yeah.
If you're not aware of that past, you're not fully appreciating the moment. To know that past makes your experience richer. So it's not problematic for me. What would be problematic is not knowing that history. To understand where that place came from and to understand that, like, you know, the American Republic, you know, stumbling fitfully towards democracy and inclusiveness, barbecue reflects the same kind of failures and hopefully a path towards success, a path towards inclusiveness. I'm working on a book now that starts in 1960 with the lunch counter sit-ins and moves forward. Southern food, I believe, began to really matter for reasons emotional, intellectual, political in the 1960s. And one of the reasons we're seeing this renaissance in Southern food in general and barbecue in particular is that it has this crazy, beautiful, tragic resonance. And if we understand the stories behind it, it makes clear what that resonance is. You kind of feel it, you sense it, you understand somehow that Southern food matters and that it's different from other regional cuisines. But when you tell those stories, you recognize why. You recognize why you're attracted to it and repelled by it at the same time. That's what Southern food does.
John T. Edge is one of the great chroniclers of Southern food. He's a James Beard Award-winning food writer who's written books about apple pie, fried chicken, and donuts. He also runs the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi's Center for the Study of Southern Culture.
People too, mess around. They're doing the mess around. They're doing the mess around. Everybody doing the mess around. Everybody was juice. You can bet your soul. They did the boogie woogie with a study roll. They mess around. They're doing the mess around. They're doing the mess around.
John T. has probably eaten at every barbecue establishment south of the Mason-Dixon line, and he says one of the best pitmasters in America is a woman from Brownsville, Tennessee. Meet the Queen of Barbecue, Helen Turner, the owner and pitmaster of Helen's Barbecue, a woman doing what used to be considered a man's job.
But now it's a woman's job.
But do people ever say anything to you like, what's a woman doing making barbecue?
I had a few guys that have said that. Where's the guy that cooking his shoulders? Oh, you know me. I'm going to say, well, you're looking at her. Oh, no. You're not the cook. Well, you're welcome to look around and see if you see anybody else.
Helen, how did you wind up in the barbecue business?
Well, I used to work for the previous owner, kind of older guy. I guess he was about in his 80s at that time. Mr. D would ask me one day, he said, well, Helen, I'm getting too old for this job right here. He said, do you want it? Basically say, well, if you go pay the taxes on it, you got it. I go, like, sure.
You're not only the owner, you're also the pit master. And from what I understand, that's where the real work is.
That's where the real work is.
Yeah, so tell me what's involved in being a pit master.
Well, involved is just pretty much going in, getting your fire started, getting 12 shoulders put on the pit, along with 5 or 6 slabs of ribs and barbecue bologna. And that's a really steady job every morning. I do this every morning for 18 years.
So what's the hardest part?
Well, you know what? It's not any of it hard. Only the hard part about it is going out there dealing with that smoke and heat and fire all day long. That's something you don't get used to, a lot of smoke. You can almost see the smoke uptown.
Is the whole room so smoky that you can barely see across it?
True.
Do you wind up tears running down your face?
Sure, all the time.
Doesn't that hurt your eyes?
Yes, it do. I take them to the doctor every once in a while and get eye drops for it.
Is there an art to the fire? Building the fire, maintaining it?
Well, it's not an art to making a fire, but it's an art to watching the pit to keep it from catching on fire. Before I learned how to do that, let me tell you a secret. The first fire I had, I thought you could take water and put it out. I found out quick, you don't take water to put out a grease fire. It exploded everywhere, just like gasoline. I mean, it just went everywhere.
Were you hurt?
I burned my eyebrows off.
Man. So now tell me what you serve.
I serve the pulled pork, the ribs, barbecue bologna. I do the smoked sausages, baked beans, potato salad, and coleslaw. And I do chicken every once in a while. You know, if somebody called, well, smoke me a chicken.
What is barbecue bologna?
See, that's another thing. I got a lot of customers from out of town, never heard of barbecue bologna.
I have never heard of barbecue bologna.
Really? I don't even know how I can explain barbecue bologna to you if you don't know.
Well, as far as I know, bologna's this thing that you get in the supermarket that comes in that big roll and they slice it off.
I use Starling bologna. I just don't use any kind of bologna. Because starting bologna is the best bologna to smoke.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So now tell me about your sauces. And they've got to be secret, right? Every great pit master has a secret sauce.
That's something I never do. I never tell anybody about my sauce.
Do people try to get you to tell them?
Yeah, and tell me. If anything happened to you, just leave me the recipe.
And what do you tell them? Is the recipe, like, in the bank?
No, it's in my brains.
Wait, you don't have it written down?
No, I do not. Thing happened to me, the sauce goes with me.
Aren't you even going to pass it on to your daughter?
Well, my daughter Nim is not interested in working at a barbecue place. Too much smoke.
Do you have regular customers, people who are like come in every day?
I do. I got regular customers to eat barbecue every day.
Do they eat the same thing each time?
They eat the same thing till when I see them coming, I already know what to fix them.
Tell me about one of them.
Okay. I'm going to say like Mayor Franklin Smith. He don't come every day, but he might come in there two or three times a week. And I know he eat chopped barbecue sandwich with slaw and mild sauce, and then he'd get him a drink.
Do you eat barbecue yourself every day?
Oh, no. Mm-mm. I might eat one once a month or once every 2 months.
You're kidding. What do
when
you
eat? You work then? Barbecue every day. You don't even want to see it. You go home smelling like it.
Yeah, you must feel like it's already part of you.
Yes, I can walk in the store. Oh, you smell so good. I could just eat you. That's just how it be all over me every day.
So, Helen, a few years ago in 2012, the Southern Foodways Alliance gave you their big award, the Ruth Fertel Keeper of the Flame Award.
Uh-huh. I got it on the wall at the barbecue place right now.
That's just great. Yes. So what did that mean to you?
Oh, it made me feel just like I was special. Because
well,
I was the only woman, you know, pit mistress. My heart just felt happy.
Well, thank you so much for talking today.
You're more than welcome.
All right. I have to head down to Brownsville sometime soon.
Please do. I'll be glad to see you.
That'd be great. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Helen Turner is the owner and pit mistress of Helen's Barbecue in Brownsville, Tennessee. Coming up, the unsavory history of barbecue's racist past, and we'll take a road trip to check out the famous Kansas City barbecue. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking barbecue in this hour, and as delicious as it is, barbecue also has an unsavory past. It goes way back to when the Europeans were first discovering the New World. Some of those early Spanish explorers noticed that indigenous Haitians and Native Americans had a way of slow-smoking meat on a framework of sticks. And when they wrote home to describe it, those explorers called that barbacoa. That's the root of the English word barbecue. But if you notice, there's another root word buried in there, barbarian. Historian Andrew Warrens says that's not an accident. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him about his new book, Savage Barbecue, Race, Culture, and the Invention of America's First Food.
Andrew, you sort of unpack the word barbecue, the etymology of this word. Where does it come from?
I think that the first occurrence of barbecue that we would recognize and connect with our own usage of the term is from the pamphlet 1707 Barbecue Feast by Ned Ward, which is the first piece I found which connected the word to, one, outdoor feasting, two, pork, pig, three, the kind of communal celebratory event outside the orbit of civilization, which it comes to be kind of celebrated as the 18th century wears on.
Tell me about this book.
This book was a massive surprise to me. I began this research as a fan of Zora Neale Hurston, thinking, as I embarked on researching barbecue, thinking that I was going to be thinking about the Caribbean, Florida, the American South. But what I actually came to realise, the more I kind of read into the archive out there, was the importance of this book, of Ned Ward's Barbecue Feast, Free Pigs of Peckham. One of the things that book does is it kind of propelled me back to my sort of home turf, if you like, back to the South London area that I grew up in. And it was a complete surprise to me to find that actually this guy, Ned Ward, who's this kind of idiosyncratic, eccentric kind of literary hack derided by the likes of Alexander Pope, actually is, as far as I've been able to find out, the first writer in the English tradition who makes that link, as I say, between barbecue, outdoor feasting, a kind of loosening up, a relaxation of the ordinary kind of conventions, a male-dominated crowd, an abandonment of cutlery, and a kind of a gorging, a kind of largesse enjoyment of feasting of outdoor cooked pork.
So what is this book? Fiction? Non-fiction? What is it?
It's an act of reportage. He is a hack. He's a journalist going around to the various festivals and fairs that are taking place in London at that time, but is then producing the most fanciful, weird, wild and wonderful reports of them. So it's, I guess we would call them acts of fiction. It's almost like a kind of gonzo journalism, a Hunter S. Thompson kind of journalism for the early years of the 18th century.
So how does this book, The Barbecue Feast, figure into your central argument that the history of barbecue is interlinked with racism?
The Barbecue Feast is presented as an opportunity for the band of Englishmen to engage in a quasi-cannibalistic feast on Peckham Rye Common, you know, just out of sight of the London walls. There's a particularly nasty moment. It's a pamphlet of about 25 pages. Particularly nasty moment where the men are all kind of gathered with their knives at the ready, ready to sort of fall upon the barbecuing pig, where the pig, as it kind of cooks, as it browns, is said to start increasingly resembling the body of an Indian squaw. And so there's a kind of imagining of a kind of cannibalistic moment in which, you know, there's a bunch of American studies scholars, Philip Deloria, who would kind of have offered books to kind of help us understand the kind of phenomenon here more in the context of the American Revolution and of American culture. But that kind of imagining of cannibalism and of a play of kind of imperial fantasy is very much part and parcel of what, on other pages of the pamphlet, you know, sounds like quite nice food. It sounds like, you know, quite a pleasant thing to eat.
One thing that you do throughout the course of your book, I mean, you have these fascinating little anecdotes of where barbecue figures into popular culture. For instance, you talk about Andrew Jackson, a president in the early 19th century, and there was a cartoon of Jackson and what was referred to as the political barbecue. Can you describe this?
Yeah, this is Martin Van Buren is at the head of the crowd of, you know, it's kind of like creates a scene that's not unlike the scene that's imagined in Ned Ward's Barbecue Feast. There's the pork in the foreground and then this motley crew of hungry men poised ready to pounce on the pig just as soon as it's ready. The difference with this cartoon is the meat that they're waiting for isn't from a pig, it's from poor old Andrew Jackson.
I mean, Andrew Jackson is actually on the spit. He is being roasted while these men are standing around, you know, waiting to eat him.
And it's a good example of, you know, that kind of the inauthenticity of barbecue in terms of its past, because you look at it and you think, well, it might not be a barbecue, it's a spit, but and yet it's called a political barbecue, which again attests to the sort of mobility that the term had, certainly in the antebellum period, if not afterwards. And so here, you know, as a literary scholar, obviously this is a kind of an opportunity that I couldn't quite pass up to sort of think about the permutations and the echoes that might lead us back to other kind of barbecue myths that I've kind of found in the archive. And there is a sort of similarity there between the political barbecue and those earlier portrayals. I guess the thing that's sort of emerging at that point is the tradition of the election day barbecue across the American South.
You meaning that, you know, on election day, people, you know, gather for barbecues, I mean, as a festive kind of occasion.
Yeah. You know, I kind of think of Robert Penn Warren's amazing book, All the King's Men, and, you know, there's a kind of late example of that kind of election day barbecue in that.
It's a food of the people, of the common people. I mean, it's not anything that the elites necessarily eat.
Yeah. Ned Ward, when he talks about his men going off to Peckham, drinking rum, there's this sort of relief. You know, it's a kind of, you can just leave civilized London behind, turn your back on it, just chill out with your mates, have a chat, get a bit drunk, eat barbecue. You know, that idea, although it's rolled up with some really nasty kind of racial images, that's definitely a kind of one of the fascinations barbecue holds for Ned Ward. And I think that it's very difficult to disentangle the racism from the conviviality when you're confronted with such a culinary phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But there is that thing that, yeah, sometimes you might want to go to a Michelin-starred restaurant and put your best clothes on and have a range of cutlery in front of you and drink fine wine. And probably if you go to such an establishment, you might be on your best behaviour. But certainly from this point, from my point of view, from, you know, Leeds, from a British point of view, what American culture gives you is the alternative. And it's an alternative which you might 9 times out of 10 prefer, which is go somewhere that's going to serve you food where you can relax and you don't need to worry too much about the niceties of cutlery protocol and all of those kinds of things. And so I think, you know, when you say it's a food of the people, you know, I think that's really comes across loud and clear in the kinds of portrayals of barbecue that I was looking at for this book.
I have to ask you about one of the reviews that came out about your book, Savage Barbecue, by Andrew Leonard in Salon.com, said that this is either the most ridiculous book ever written about America's defining grassroots food or the most profound, or perhaps it is both.
Yeah.
What do you make of those comments?
Well, you know, they're kind of branded on my brain and I kind of recite them to myself just before I go to sleep every night. In a way, and this might be my own kind of permanent indoctrination into the academic system, but I kind of struggle to see what is quite as contentious about the assertions I'm making in the first half of the book about the etymology of barbecue, because I kind of think it's there. You know, it's there in the colonial archive, and I think it's almost a kind of matter of record. That's cannibalism. It means different forms of racism, fantasies about what so-called savages or Indians are up to outside of the range of kind of colonial power. And so I kind of think it's, as a thesis, it's actually a little bit more modest and also a little bit more empirical than Andrew Leonard suggests in that review.
I have to ask, do you eat barbecue yourself?
Yeah, whenever I have the opportunity, I eat barbecue. Barbecue here in Leeds is often thwarted by the weather. And when it does stop raining for long enough, we get out there and we kind of, you know, have some incinerated sausages and kind of wash it down with plenty of booze. And, you know, that's one kind of barbecue that I enjoy.
So when you are eating barbecue, enjoying barbecue with your booze, are you contemplating this history that you've outlined as well?
It depends who I'm with, what I've been doing, and what the atmosphere in the barbecue joint is.
Andrew Warrens is a lecturer in American literature and culture at Leeds University in the UK. He's the author of Savage Barbecue, race, culture, and the invention of America's first food. He talked with Steve Paulson. You could describe America as the United States of barbecue, because every region has its signature style. There's Memphis barbecue, North and South Carolina barbecue, the Texas and the Alabama variations, and then there's Kansas City, an equal opportunity employer when it comes to meat. In Kansas City, they slow smoke it all, pork, chicken, beef, even turkey. Then they slather it with their famous sweet tomato molasses sauce. Writer and barbecue authority Doug Wargle takes us to his hometown favorite, Joe's Kansas City Barbecue in Olathe, Kansas.
Hot barbecue today!
We use nothing but Missouri white oak in our smokers. Missouri white oak, we found, is very consistent. It's got a nice mid-range smoke. Hickory is probably the most well-known wood in barbecue, but we find that can be a little bitter and inconsistent. So we use nothing but Missouri white oak.
Hot barbecue!
Missouri white oak is also the wood that is used in making bourbon barrels. And that's not a coincidence. The same qualities in Missouri white oak that make it good for bourbon, which is the vanillin and the sugars that are in that wood, also make it great for barbecue as well. We like everything about the Missouri white oak. It works really well for us.
Hot barbecue!
The whole key to Kansas City barbecue, generally, is cook low and slow. Low temperature, long period of time. Brisket and pork butt, which are the two fundamental cuts of meat in barbecue, along with ribs, they're tough cuts of meat and very fatty. They're not good cuts of meat unless you cook them for a very long period of time. What that does is that brings the temperature up gradually while rendering fat out, leaving it moist, and it also tends to break down those connective tissues. When you're done, you've got a very nice, tender piece of meat that's still very moist and very juicy, and lots of great bark. We call it bark. It's crust on the outside.
Hot barbecue!
Kansas City, we use a lot of rub to cook the meat. Most of the flavor comes from the smoke and the rub. You know, and our rub has salt and sugar. It's got garlic powder, onion powder. It's got celery seed. It's got cayenne. It's got some other good stuff in there.
Hot barbecue!
A lot of people will say Kansas City slathers its barbecue in sauce. That's not true. That's a smear on Kansas City barbecue by those Texan purists who don't believe in any sauce at all. We put a little bit of sauce on our barbecue, but a well-balanced dish of any kind has the full range of flavors.
Hot barbecue!
Doug Wargle works for Joe's Kansas City Barbecue in Olathe, Kansas. He's also a writer and the author of a barbecue novel called Thin Blue Smoke. Producer Aubrey Ralph brought us the story. Coming up, here's an unlikely plot for a novel. A psychiatrist is struck by lightning and, after being nearly singed to death, becomes obsessed with barbecue. Meet the author of Man Alive after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. This hour, we're talking barbecue in history, folklore, restaurants, and fiction. So how's this for a premise for a novel? Owen Lerner is a pediatric psychiatrist. One day, while he's putting a quarter into a parking meter, he's struck by lightning. He survives, but things are a little different because Owen has developed a new obsession with barbecue. Mary Kay Zaravlev's the author of Man Alive. Doug Gordon sat down with her.
Mary Kay, what inspired you to write Man Alive?
Well, I had read an article in The New Yorker by Oliver Sacks about a surgeon who was struck by lightning. And this guy heard piano compositions while he was being struck. And he was not a composer. He was not a pianist. You know, he'd taken piano lessons as a kid. So he actually went on this quest to learn how to play the piano and to learn how to transcribe what he had heard so he could get that on paper. And I loved that article, but not first for a plot idea. I loved it because that's the metaphor I had always used to talk about writing, that it took me a very long time to get the music I heard in my head on paper. So then I was just, it was time to write a new book, and I sat down, I was at an art colony, and I sat down to write a short story, because that's how I sort of warm up, and I thought, oh, a pediatric psychopharmacologist is struck by lightning, and all he wants to do is barbecue. Okay. So that's how it started.
So where did this, you know, idea of being struck by lightning and becoming obsessed with barbecue come from?
I don't know. I'm from Oklahoma, so there's barbecue. There's barbecue in my subconscious. There's barbecue in my gut. That could be it. But it also, I read a lot about how kids learn and how they can't learn and what's normal and what isn't, and neurotypicals. I love the term neurotypicals. So I think that the pediatric psychopharmacologist comes from there. And then I don't know where it came from. The phrase, I just said it over and over again to myself. A pediatric psychopharmacologist is struck by lightning and all he wants to do is barbecue. It would be my mantra.
In one interview, you said that you have something of an electricity fetish. Can you
I
tell
do,
me about
actually.
That?
Sure. I say that I was raised by a tribe of electrical engineers. There are a lot of electrical engineers in my family, and their talent with circuitry and electronics does not extend to their emotional and social interactions. And I went to Rice University, which was also a place that was really talented people, not known for their social and emotional interactions. And that disconnect is fascinating to me, people who know so much but can't necessarily tell you about it or have a conversation with you. I love the idea of electricity as both mystery and completely explicable. What's the big deal? And people letting in certain things in their life without question, but then you say yoga. Ooh, not yoga. Yeah. And we all have those doors, right?
Right.
This is in, but this is not in. This is weird, but this is not weird. And so, you know, this book is about what's normal.
Yeah. A lot of writers will start a novel. There's a question that prompts the novel, a question that they want to wrap their brain around and explore through the course of a novel. Does that apply to you?
It's funny that you say a lot of writers, because that's exactly what I do. I'm writing to a question. So for this book, aside from my mantra, the question was, how much are you allowed to change within a family unless you don't want to be in that family anymore? So when I would say to people, oh, the premise is, and I would give them the psychopharmacologist and barbecue and ha, ha, ha. And then I would say, but really, the book is about how much can you change within a family unless you don't want to be in that family? And people would invariably go, huh. And this friend of mine said, well, you know, that's our biggest fear and our biggest hope, that we'll escape all by ourselves, but we won't be abandoned.
Yeah. Now would probably be a good time to have you read an excerpt from Man Alive.
Okay, great. The intersection of Owen's obsession and everyone else's dinner is an oasis for Tony, who undoubtedly feels October's chill more keenly than her guests. To extend the season, she totes out lap blankets and extra sweatshirts from the back of the basement closet. This can't go on forever, but she's hopeful that it doesn't have to. Meanwhile, Owen gives himself over to the fire. With the dedication he once brought to meds, he studies woods, twigs to trunks. From the strong flavors of hickory and mesquite, he moves on to the subtleties of mulberry and the delicate sweetness of alder. Wild cherry is delivered to his Bethesda backyard, followed by a truckload of red oak. No bark, only what the aficionados call the heart core. Aromatic grapevines with their curling tendrils of surprising strength and elasticity, and of course the gnarled wood of the apple tree. When cast out of the garden, did Adam wrench a limb from the apple tree and burn it for fuel? What a poignant, bittersweet flavor that must have imparted. He goes down the same rabbit hole for meat. He's already made buddies out of the UPS and FedEx drivers who deliver his internet finds, and he gets cell phone calls from the butcher at Giant who likes to talk shop. Organic, grass-fed, and aged meat leads Owen to the Farm Women's Co-op in Bethesda and the Tacoma Park Farmers Market before he's off to the farms themselves. Soon he thinks nothing of driving to Culpeper or Emmitsburg to visit Hedge Apple, Shagbark Mountain, or Fox Hollow Farm for a lamb. The new deep freezer in the garage is packed with white bundles wrapped and labeled like presents. After meeting the right cow, he buys half of her. He likens his single-mindedness to a ball player enduring endless batting sessions, hoping to preserve the feel of a homer. Come to think of it, he doesn't have to look beyond his own circle of friends for working habits that present as crazy. Steve has been traveling to Hong Kong all year for depositions and a trial, having just come off a trial in West Virginia. What is the point of that work, which Steve despairingly describes as taking place in generic office buildings and among chain restaurants that render Hong Kong and West Virginia indistinguishable? What is the point of the 2-volume Herbert Hoover biography Betsy published when it doesn't even bring her tenure? Of course, another person might ask, what is the point of barbecue?
Excellent. So I know I asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again, why barbecue?
Why barbecue? Well, these ideas come to you, and then as you're writing, you can't believe these ideas came to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're free to go back and change, and you do a million times. But why barbecue? You know, as I started writing this, the idea that he was prescribing medication for people to behave normally, and the conundrum of that natural, primitive meat fire versus the kind of stuff he's doing that you've just seen here, where he's traveling 100 miles from home to get exactly the cut of oak. And when he meets the right cow, he bought half of her. I mean, he's going well out of his way on this search for a very natural meal.
Yeah. You kind of touched on it there, but I'm wondering, is there a connection to be made between lightning often causing fires and the burning involved in the creation of barbecue?
Absolutely. And that smell that he so wants. I mean, you know, his kids say to him, oh, for God's sake, that was you. You on fire, pal.
Yeah.
That's not what he wants to believe.
No. Is Owen's newfound obsession with barbecue serving as some kind of metaphor? Do you see that as a metaphor at all?
I do. And I see it as a quest, too. That which is discovered is just as valuable as that which we abandoned. And the earliest things we knew are just as treasured as what you're going to pick up tomorrow on the internet. I mean, that's constantly playing against itself. Some people will say to me, oh, is this a diatribe against medicating children? It isn't. Mm-hmm. It's a question of what the hell is normal. And I'm constantly juxtaposing these two things. You know, we test our children. There's a running thread through the book of these SAT vocabulary tests, right? The twin brothers are teasing or teaching their younger sister words for the SAT vocab. And they're never words that you use in conversation. So isn't that kind of hilarious that we're testing our children's language ability using words that are never used in conversation? That's normal.
Yeah.
And asking kids to sit still for hours and hours a day. And now finding medicine or coping mechanisms so they can do that. That's normal.
Yeah. And one of the things I found interesting is the way that the lightning strike changes Owen. He becomes more like his kids, the children he works with who have Asperger's syndrome and other kinds of autism. And I'm curious, was that something you had in mind when you first conceived of the character of Owen Lerner, or did that develop as you were writing the book?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is the distinction between like a short story, which I thought I was writing, and a novel. So, you know, the premise just came to me, and then I started playing with it. I wrote the scene where he's struck by lightning just out of my imagination. And then I started doing a little research to make sure that I'm somewhat on the mark. And when I realized that people who aren't killed by lightning have exactly the symptoms that he has been treating for 25 years, I thought, oh, this is not a short story. This is a novel. So that was a huge leap.
Yeah.
That this is what he is a specialist in, impulse control, post-traumatic stress, Asperger-like symptoms. That's what he's been talking about for his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the go-to guy for that, you know, medical concoction, which for some children is essential.
One little minor detail I wanted to ask you about happens just after Owen has been struck by lightning. One of the twins, his son Ricky, is administering CPR. to Owen, and Ricky recites barbecue spare ribs, between breaths as kind of a timing mechanism. Is that a real thing, or did you make that up?
I made that up.
Okay. It should be a real thing, and maybe it will be now. That was great.
It's like one Mississippi, right? It's just the right number of syllables.
Yeah. I've read that there was a line that you'd been carrying around for a while and that you ended up using it in the book. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So there's a British sociologist named Adam Phillips who writes a lot. He's very prolific. And I was reading an article of his one day about families coping with a member of the family who has Asperger's. And his line was, "The secret to family life is to not take it personally." And I mean, I thought my head was going to explode because I just thought that is the perfect piece of advice an outsider can give to someone in a family who cannot take that advice. It's impossible to take, even though it's actually good advice. You know, why can't this child sit through Thanksgiving dinner with 20 people and food, the texture of which is upsetting and there's all this noise going on? Why can't he? He cannot. And it's not something personal. Meanwhile, when you're in the family, you cannot abide by that. So then I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll put Owen in the situation of having to take his own advice, and we'll see how that goes.
Mary Kay Zurovlev. Her novel is called Man Alive. She talked with Doug Gordon. That's it for today's show. Hopefully we've given you something to think about next time you tuck into a plate of smoked ribs. If you like what you heard, did you know you can subscribe to our podcast? That way you'll get all our new shows delivered so that you can hear them whenever you want. The link is on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Today's show was produced by our resident barbecue fan, Doug Gordon. He had help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Emma Roskowski. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.